Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive, celebrating 25 years. Our 25th anniversary documentary, helped and narrated by so many rock and roll Hall of Famers like Gina Schock and friends of mine like Mike Brillhart, John Allen, and Mickey Coachella, my dear friend Ray Bachman, who will be at the Heart Cheap Trick show on Monday night. Maybe he can wear my backup Cheap Trick belt buckle. On Friday, we're going to be at Fadley's having crab cakes. Luke Jones and I are going to gather for Mother's Day. We're going to be giving away the Pac-Man scratch-offs in the Maryland Lottery. Also have these next Friday, the Orioles into a nice little chunky homestand here. First place Orioles. All of it brought to you by our friends at Liberty Pure Solutions, bringing my water clean and clear to me, as well as Jiffy Lube Multicare. I am drinking my Royal Farms coffee. It's morning as we're taping this. I've been awake for like 6 hours and it's 8 a.m. And, you know, there's nothing better than good, fresh Royal Farms coffee out of the cold roofing mug with a real author. With a guy that writes real books, not baseball books, not Castro's Cuba, not like how awesome the 1991 World Series was or anything like that. But I know him through baseball. He was at one time one of my favorite baseball writers. He's moved away from the game a little bit to more serious novel work, and his work as a tenured professor at Johns Hopkins University. We welcome Tim Wendell back onto the program, our defending champion. And dude, I was going to talk Rubenstein with you and Orioles and Craig Kimbrell and starting pitching and all that. And I'm like, dude, I'm doing like Civil War, like sort of pseudo history novel writing now. And I'm like, well, you know, your time at Johns Hopkins, you've changed, Tim Wendell. You're not the guy I knew worried about the starting rotation, right?
I still worry about it a little bit, but not as much as I used to. That's for sure, Nestor. So, no, we're doing new book, Rebel Falls, and actually it drops next week. So it's
when did you decide to go serious and stop writing in the toy department and worrying about things such as press credentials and what things like that?
Well, I don't know. When I saw the state of baseball sometimes, I said, man, I gotta branch out a little bit. But I think you just follow what you're interested in. I mean, I'm married to an incredible author myself. My wife Jackie's a very successful ghostwriter, and I'll get latched on to certain things like I did with Rebel Falls about what I think is one of the biggest what ifs of the Civil War. And I'll start doing a little bit of research. I'll find out a little bit and I'll start talking to her about it at the dinner table. And may 1 week goes
by. She'll
say,
you should write about that, Tim.
That's about 10 days.
Dr. Wendell.
10 day limit. She just goes, you know, I've kind of done with this. Maybe you should write about it. So that's where I jump in and do it up.
You know, I've never done a This Is Your Life with you. So give me the I just did my documentary. it began as like a 5 or 7 minute sales piece from I had some sales meetings in January, February. People say, well, tell me about yourself. And I'm like, where do I start after 40 years of doing this? Like, I don't know how to give you 2 minutes of that. So I put this documentary thing together. But everywhere I go, there's such a credibility about people I know who have credibility. And you're one of them. Right. And I try to have nothing but credible people on the show, the podcast, the radio show. I don't know which is more impressive, the radio station, the video, the YouTube, the social.
Oh, it's all of it.
But it's communication,
package.
Right? I mean,
oh, sure.
And it's for people like you and me that learned how to write when we were kids, that you're still writing. I write as often as I can and have time. And between selling, doing, webbing, we have a new website coming out this week. I just worked on this documentary really crazy. I do this charity work, all this stuff. But, you know, you've moved away from your original thing, and I don't say I moved back to it, but I am now fighting with a new baseball owner about press passes with the first place
team.
I
was wondering about
right.
That.
You know, it is whether I'm under review, you know, which isn't bad if the New York Times is reviewing your book, but I'm under review. And I'm like, what the hell are you reviewing? Whether
I hope
I'm
you're
a real
not
journalist
on a double
or not?
Secret probation. Or
yeah,
like
exactly.
That, you know?
I better watch what I say. I mean, if I put the pen up my nose and play the class clown, they won't let me. So, but for you, you aspired, I think. And if you watch my documentary, I said all I ever really wanted to be was Oscar Madison. And my favorite part of the documentary for me is I unearthed this John Stedman audio of him talking about a young Nestor as a reporter and the guy he knew as a 16, 17, 18 year old kid writing, chasing rock stars. I was like, you came to me as like a baseball, I don't want to say you're a baseball god, but you had a job that I wanted when I was a kid, which is he runs around and writes about baseball all week for a tabloid magazine, and he's having the time of his life, and he just profiled Rico Carty or whatever you were doing at the time. But I found you as a baseball writer, and every one of you who was smart that I ever knew, Kevin Cowherd, go on and on and on, came to me at some point in my life and said, kid, give up the baseball card thing. Get serious, because these people are trash. The whole industry is a mess. It's always been a mess. They're all a bunch of louses. It's louses taking over for louses in general. And we have an owner squirting the fans in left field now, so we're all excited about it here. But you were baseball first in the way that I was baseball. And you, at one point, dedicated your whole life to that, right? And even a couple of books afterward, right?
Oh, yeah. And several baseball books, you know, High Heat, Summer of 68. Down to the last pitch. I still love baseball. I watch baseball, but you know, as you mentioned, you get a little bit deeper into it, and it's I don't know. It's maybe not quite what you imagined it would be, and at some point, you kind of do this maybe the same thing over and over. You know, what's the new hot team? Who just won 8 in a row? I better go cover them. Oh, who just lost 5 or 6? Oh, I better cover them. And you just kind of, it's almost like in Casablanca, round up the usual suspects. You just got to swap out the teams a little bit and away you go. But I still love it. But at times I did what, baseball for 20, 25 years? And then, you know, getting the gig at Hopkins kind of branches you out a little bit, seeing what some of my students were doing. I counted the other day, I've now had, Nestor, 30 plus students publish their first books, both fiction and nonfiction. And the great thing about teaching, the hours suck, but in a sense, you learn things from your students and you go, wow, look what they're doing. That's interesting. And then away it went. And one of the things I was very fortunate about growing up, I grew up in Lockport, New York. Very
where is
small.
That? Where's that?
It's on the Erie Canal between Buffalo and Rochester, and it's
God,
almost in middle
of nowhere. Well, my God, where you were, huh?
Yep, I was on the edge of nowhere.
I mean, snowed a hell of a lot where you were. No wonder you left.
A lot of snow. Yeah,
you
play
baseball there. You could ski there.
But there's a couple prominent people from Lockport. Joyce Carol Oates is from Lockport. I met her years ago. We now email, which is kind of weird. And but I met her once actually at a gig in Fairfax at George Mason University. And she found out that I was from Lockport. She ended up kind of coming over, and all we did was talk about Lockport for about 20 minutes. I found out later I was then put on the blacklist, never invited to anything at Mason again because it felt like I had dominated her time. But she's the one who wanted to talk about Lockport. And at one point she I knew the part of Lockport she grew up in. She was on the west side, more highways, shopping malls.
Was she legendary to you then?
Yes. And mostly because she was so prolific. And then she asked, where are you? You know, where are you from in Lockport?
Oh, you're a writer, right? Like,
I'm a writer. And I start to go, well, I
cover
on the
baseball.
Opposite side of town. Yeah, I cover baseball. I was at that point. And she's kind of looking at me like, ooh. And I said, I was on the other side of town, past Lower Town, past Widewater's Marina, right by the canal. And she started the Erie Canal, and her eyes start getting bigger. And she had these talons, Nestor, for fingernails. And she reached out and grabbed a hold of my forearm and just kind of squeezed. And I thought she was going to, you know, draw blood.
How
and,
do you type with talons? You know, on old typewriters in the 60s and 70s.
And she just
you know?
Flew. And she leans in, and her eyes are wide. She goes, oh, Tim. That's the real Lockport. And I went, oh, maybe I should do a little bit more. And the other guy who had a huge impact on me, see, I was supposed to be an engineer. I was supposed to be a civil engineer. Oh my God, that would have been awful. And because my father was, my grandfather was, I was supposed to inherit the family engineering firm. Now that went off the tracks. And the other guy who had a huge impact on my life was Brock Yates. You ever hear that cat?
Sure.
He wrote Cannonball Run, several of the Smokey and the Bandit movies. He's my second uncle. And he would come into my life.
Hold on. Stop everything.
What?
Your second uncle wrote Smokey and the Bandit?
Yes. And he would come into my life periodically. And here I am in a family of engineers, and everybody's pretty serious and let's build a bridge or something, which doesn't seem like a lot of fun to me. And here would come Brock. Here would come Uncle Brock.
Dr. Louise and Terry Bradshaw smoking dope in the 70s and making movies.
That's right. And he would come in, and I was going, this guy is having a hell of a lot more fun than I'm having. So in a sense, he had a major impact on me becoming a writer.
Sheriff Buford T. Justice. Someone in your family created that character.
Yeah,
you
all
know?
Those lines sometimes. And the whole
Tim, you look a little taller on the radio. Tim Wenzel's here. He has been covering. So back to the beginning. How does a kid from like the middle of nowhere fall in love with baseball in a not? I come at it honest, and I tell this Ben McDonald story because he calls the games on Mass. I remember going out to lunch with Ben in the early 1990s when Ben was Ben and he was going to be the guy with the Orioles. He took me to lunch at the Benihana. You want to go to Benihana? Me, you, and Brad Pennington. We go to Benihana. I'll buy you lunch, nasty. So he told me growing up in Louisiana, he had only been to one Major League Baseball game before he ever pitched in one. My dad had took me to the Astrodome one time to see Nolan Ryan pitch, you know? And I'm like, my last name's Aparicio. I don't know anything other. I went to the ballpark all the time with my father loved baseball. It was all I did. And then when I was 15 years old, I got a job at the News American. And the first story I ever wrote, I called Hartshorn, Oklahoma, and interviewed Warren Spahn.
Wow.
It's all in the documentary. And I remember Warren Spahn for being joked about in the Bad News Bears second edition at the Astrodome. He made a cameo. So for me, baseball was my life, and it's all I ever wanted to do. And then, you know, I find myself fighting with Peter Angelos as a 40-year-old trying to get the team sold, and it's taken 18 years for all that to happen. But I almost forgot how much of my life – I've been to 58 World Series games.
Have you really?
With press passes. I haven't been to one in a while, not around here anyway, but I hopefully soon. But like, I love baseball, and there's people in my life like you that we connected for this period of time where baseball was all in our life. And now, you know, I'm doing what I'm doing, and we're documentaries, and you're writing Civil War Day and whatever. But like, it always comes back to us, though. You've watched a baseball game in the last week, Tim. You have, right?
Oh, sure. The way the Orioles are playing. I'm watching them. I still got my Masson thing or whatever, but it's funny. You know, you were just talking there about how the thread goes back. I mean, I grew up at a time, obviously, you know, older, a little bit older than you, where I couldn't stream anything. I wasn't quite sure what the players looked like. I was looking at box scores, and I still remember, say, the Red Sox in 67. That was my little league team, the Red Sox. And then 68, you know, with the Tigers and the Cardinals. And it's not like I'm watching them a lot, but I'm following the narrative through box scores and such. And it was great. It was a lot of fun because you could kind of make your own story. Oh, what does that – what do they do here? Whatever. And do you ever play – oh, God, we used to play Sports Illustrated, the baseball game. With the dice, you know, you could make
So Stratomatic was big in my
Stratomatic was big.
My dad liked APBA. He ordered that off the back of sporting. But yeah, board games
we played
SI
so much.
I played ball. You know what I mean? Like we played wiffle ball, tennis ball, hardball, little league, ball. I mean, and then we weren't doing that. We played football and basketball like everybody. You know, I didn't play soccer or lacrosse in my neighborhood. I played a lot of tennis. But baseball was everything because it's Baltimore. Like in the 70s, and Brooks is still playing, and it's all just Ripken's about to happen and all of that. To have the last 30 years here and to chronicle it the way I have and being the only one that's been honest about most of it, I find it – like I'm drawn back to it now because the community's getting drawn back to it with the new owner and like all of this stuff. But I find people like you that have like, I'm writing Civil War stuff now. I'm doing different things in my life. And – I have so much respect for that because sometimes it's like a mafia you can't get out. But with the media shrinking and everything that you saw, you took your life in a different direction. But like you probably wanted to cover baseball your whole life and do nothing but baseball, right?
Yeah, certainly for a point. And I love bringing people into baseball. What was that? I think two summers ago, they had the Sabre convention there in Baltimore. And I went up and one of my editors, dear friend, a guy named Rob Taylor, who's at University of Nebraska Press. We've done a couple books together. He had never been to Camden. And, you know, and he's busy. You know, he's got his booth there at Sabre and he's meeting with people. And I kept going, Rob, they're playing. We're going to go. I've got you a ticket. Please come. Let's go. And I pretty much pulled him away from his booth. And I got him in the Camden. And it was like one of those great moments. And not so much the game, but we sit down and all of a sudden he's just kind of looking around and he's quiet for about an inning or two.
Cathedral. And kind of,
yeah. And I'm going, are you okay? And he had the great line. He goes, this is better. This is much better than I expected. And I went, cool. I've done my job, you know.
And I would have said to him, if I were there, I'd have been the smart ass. And imagine when Angelos doesn't own anymore, how good it's going to be.
That's right. Imagine Brooks, if he was playing third base at this place.
So how did you fall in love with baseball, though, to love it as much as you did, being from where you were? Box scores. I mean, I get all of that. But, like, what was your experiential part of going to a game in the middle of nowhere? I mean, I guess going up to Buffalo going to a minor league game?
Yeah, minor league game in Buffalo. I played a little bit at Little League, but my grandfather used to take me to games. He was a big baseball fan, and he would take me to games in Buffalo. Now, people need to remember, they know that stadium, and everybody kind of knows it who's
Rock
watching.
Rock Pile, the Natural.
The Natural. And right. So, and there's a moment in the Natural where, you know, they take out the, in a sense, experienced pitcher, and they kind of bring in the guy who looks like Redford back in the day and all this stuff. And they kind of set up this deal. And anybody who's read the book knows it's not all beautiful at the end. It's more tragedy. But the guy pitching that they take out, the experienced pitcher, was a guy named Phil Rosenberg. Phil Rosenberg went to Lockport Senior High School. Amazing pitcher. Amazing pitcher. He was drafted, obviously never made it, got a little bit hurt. So when people kind of go, hang on, I saw that Natural, that's a lot different than the book by Bernard Malamud, you know, what happened? That I went, it would have been exactly the same if they kept Phil Rosenberg in the game, but instead they set up this other thing. And I loved that stadium. That stadium was great. I saw Mike Epstein hit 3 homers there one time in a game. And that's also where the Bills played for a little bit. It's no longer exists. And it's a real tragedy because, unlike Baltimore, the mistake Buffalo keeps making over and over again is they don't have their stadium downtown. They're building now a new stadium that's literally right across the street from the existing football stadium in Orchard Park, and going to be as much of snow and problems as the current one is.
Smoking like a true Western New Yorker, fact and fiction and baseball and fantasy. And he's written about all of this stuff. The good doctor, Tim Wendell's here. New book, Cornell University Press. I got to promote all this, Rebel Falls. Not baseball related, but certainly
there is a baseball scene in it, though. I always seem to include one now. So
during the Civil War, it was a baseball.
Oh, yeah, they were playing. You know, there was not quite the game we know today, but both sides were playing it. But
pre-Doubleday or post-Doubleday?
I don't know. Here comes Doubleday. I forgot my history on that one.
Yeah, I don't know. They make it all up in Cooperstown anyway. So you decided to write. This is not your first book I want to get the word right. It's not fiction, but it's Civil War. But you tell me what it is. You're the writer.
It's historical fiction. And this is probably the... Okay. Castro's Curveball was historical fiction. So was the sequel to that. So a little bit of experience with it. But what the start of it, the genesis of it was, Nestor, I love reading endnotes, not footnotes, but endnotes. Hey, how did they put this together? Like in the back of a book, like Eric Larson, who used to live in Baltimore, does this a great deal. I love it. And I was reading Team of Rivals, Doris Kearns Goodwin. And I got to like the end and I'm going, hang on, there's these two guys she's mentioning, just briefly, but mentioning, John Yates Bell, Bennett Burley. Who the hell were these cats? They were Confederate spies along the Canadian border in the last couple months of the Civil War. All right, big deal. What'd they try to do? They almost seized the only Union warship on the Great Lakes. Oh, what's that mean? It means if they had gotten it, they were going to shell Toledo, Cleveland, Erie, Buffalo on the eve of the presidential election. Lincoln probably loses. And I went, this is interesting. And I was also intrigued because, as we were just talking about with the Natural and Buffalo, I love Niagara Falls. I grew up 15 miles away from Niagara Falls. And all this intrigue, this espionage, this spies on both sides, the Union and the Confederate, are all centered in Niagara Falls, Toronto, Montreal at that point. And I went, this would be a lot of fun to write. And we kind of are so...
What was Canada at that point, historically? Like
Canada was a dominion of Britain. But what is interesting that there's in the history books, if they touch on this at all, when we're in high school or in college, they'll talk about, oh, Canada was the place, you know, escaped slaves were trying to reach. It was like the end point for the Underground Railroad. That's all true. But it was also had a great deal of backing the South. A lot of the churches, a lot of the businesses, a lot of the banks, the newspapers, they were all for the South. Why? It would have been a better business deal. When they pulled John Wilkes Booth out of that farmhouse where he's been shot 12 days after assassinating Lincoln in Port Royal, Virginia, they're going through his pockets. Okay. Oh, and they find some change, you know, a pocket knife, a diary he's been keeping. That's kind of interesting. But the thing that blew their mind was they pulled out a banknote from a bank in Montreal. That's where he was getting all his money. That's where he was getting his support to first hatch the plan to kidnap Lincoln and then the genesis to assassinate Lincoln. I mean, Canada's a very interesting place. And I can say that. I married a Canadian. So in a sense, it's bizarre how it plays out, the backdrop during the Civil War.
So the book is, when did the book drop?
Book will officially drop in about 2 days, three days.
Oh, so this... Wow, this is good. I'm warming you up for all the press you're going to be doing for Rebel Falls. Tim Wendell's here. So how often are you in Baltimore? Give everybody your story, because you're a Hopkins writer.
Yeah, I get up there periodically.
Writer in residence, was that the official title? What do they call it?
Writer
you?
In residence. Yeah, I still remember when they
called
offered
you tenured
title.
Something. I don't know. I don't know all of
that. I said, writer in residence. What does that have? What does that mean? I was like, oh, it's more committee meetings or something. And they said, no, you've only got to do two things. You've got to write and you've got to reside. And I went, I can do those two things. Outside of that, it gets a little bit nuts.
What is the residing part contain? What is that?
I come on up periodically, but so much of now Nestor is virtual that pretty much I reside in this nether world.
Well, you have this great virtual microphone, dude. Just professional.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It's like an air traffic controller. It's like you.
No, you sound great on the radio, though. It's perfect, man. It's exactly where you need to be. So the book comes out, and what is the modern writing a book? You want to be the New York Times bestseller. The genre of doing this is very, there's still people that read books. I know people that read books.
Eric
DaCosta still read books, right? Books on tape. There's audio books. I had an author on 2 weeks ago with a book. I'm like, I'm going to read your book, but I have Geddy Lee's book in front of it for the first trip. And I have Rick Emmett's book from Triumph. And after I get through those, I'll get to your book, Tim. You know, so I'm sort of lining up my summer reading. I got to find a vacation first and find a pool to lay at because I've been kind of busy. But just writing and for an audience, clearly different than writing baseball books, right?
You know, you always try to find your community, so to speak. And I think sometimes that's the mistake some writers make. They'll either try to pitch a book, they'll try to sell a book, even, you know, go out with a book to promote it. And they aren't quite sure what the community is. I'm pretty sure I know what the community is with this. I mean, it's historical buffs, you know, Civil War, especially the last, you know, potentially maybe speculative history. And so it's fun. And in fact, one of the guys who's big in Rebel Falls is William Seward, who is Secretary of State at that point in time in 1864 when this takes place. And the Seward family is arguably the most powerful family in the North at that point. He's Secretary of State. He could have been president, but Lincoln beat him out, etc. He's the guy who goes on and buys Alaska from Russia. And I'm going to be doing...
But not Greenland.
Greenland. No, that's a different one. That's
president.
Mr. Green.
Sorry.
But... So anyway, I'll be doing a gig, 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks at the Seward House in Auburn, New York. And I'm looking forward to that. That's part of a big swing we're doing through upstate New York. And I'll probably end up in Lockport, too.
Well, I mean, you're writing Civil War history, right? Like, anytime I'm anywhere near Antietam, I did the crab cake tour. I had never been to the fields out there and really read about the tragedy there. And, you know, you learn about this stuff in eighth grade, and then you either revisit it or you wind up in Gettysburg for a day or, you know... But the trail of Manassas going down to Bull Run and so I see all of these battlefields as part of, oh, I'm going to a concert. Oh, I'm going to have a crab cake. Oh, I'm driving out to Deep Creek Lake, or I'm going up to Pittsburgh. And you go to Pittsburgh now, you see Somerset, you see the 9/11 and everything that's going on there. But we have such a fertile soil here in the area where you are at Hopkins, Baltimore, Washington, all the Lincoln stuff and trains and coming in and sneaking in and out of Baltimore and all of that stuff that's so rich for all of this. And you see it anywhere you go to flea markets, weekends, Civil War history, all of that. I would think you'll be doing stuff in the area here, right? Like Baltimore
Oh,
will be
sure.
rich for this, right?
Yeah, Baltimore would be up. And it's funny because I think sometimes we tend to put the Civil War maybe too far back. You know, we just had, you know, I live here in Charlottesville. All the
Oh, boy.
statues have been taken down. We had the Unite the Right thing in 2017. In some ways, you know, we're still fighting this war. We're still debating what, how it should be remembered, you know, how it should be immortalized. And it's interesting because you dig just a little bit deep. I mean, it's just been in recent weeks and recent months that they finally are taking down the Confederate War Memorial at Arlington Cemetery. You just go, what is that doing there? And yet it's been there forever. And so how this, you know, we tend to think history's written and then it's put away. In the case of the Civil War, history is being rewritten a lot. And one of the things that blows my mind is often it's the victors that write, in a sense, the history books. In the case of the Civil War, sometimes, in a lot of cases, it hasn't been, you
It's the
know,
aggrieved, yeah, to some
the
degree.
Aggrieved, it's a lost cause.
Tim, a little interesting piece. I didn't even think about this, but my mother is from the Deep South, Abbeville, South Carolina. At one point, Julia Roberts called it the most racist place she had ever been, and she grew up in Georgia. She grew up in Smyrna. So she shot Sleeping with the Enemy in literally the house across the street from the house my mother grew up in on Magazine Street in Abbeville, South Carolina. So I lost my mother 6 years ago. And at the end of my mom lived to be 98. I mean, she lived a beautiful life. At the end of her life, I kept threatening to take her to what she would call home because that was her hometown. And all during the 70s, I watched every one of Nolan Ryan's no hitters in Abbeville, South Carolina on rabbit ears, like literally, right? In the 78, 79, they had cable television there before we had it here at my aunt's house. So I would go down there in the summer and have TBS and watch cartoons, and it was awesome. But I went back for the first time in 30 years. Last time I was back there was probably 1985, so it was even longer, 40 years. I went back to see Sammy Hagar in Greenville, South Carolina, on my birthday 6 months ago. It was when the Orioles got eliminated. If the Orioles had played the Astros and won, I couldn't do the trip. It was like October 20th. So I went down to Abbeville, South Carolina, and I knew all of this through my family and my mother and her sister. They were deeply Southern, you know what I mean? Still are. My mother's brother's kids are Confederate, over the top, trumped out, like had to throw them off my Facebook. I went down in October. My mother's grandfather, my mother was born in 1919. My mother's grandfather was a Civil War hero. His name was Thompson. He has a plaque, not a statue, but a plaque. The brothers of the Confederate Army, Abbeville colonels. He was a colonel. He lived afterward. Came back, had a family for a while, lived into the 1790s. Plaque up. It literally is in front of the Civic Center, which isn't like the Baltimore. It's more like a gym, more like a community center in Abbeville. And I went and found it. I hadn't been to the Abbeville in 40 years, and I went to this little town. And it was just as I remembered it. I grew up, I spent, you know, 10 summers of my, not summers, but 2 weeks of my summer, longer than I wanted to be there chasing crickets. Trust me, in July when the Orioles were in the pennant race in 79, trying to listen to those games on BAL. I remember that. The beer was not cold for any Chuck Thompson fan out there. But I went down there and like, I don't have a perspective as to whether that should be there or not and whether the name should be there or not. I know it was very important to my mother's family. I know it's twisted and weird, and the whole trail of all of it and spending any amount of time down there, you still sense that we haven't moved too far away from where we were. And but I think for anybody in the South, I have a South story and it comes right to the door of my family frontage. And it's something I never talked to my mother about. And her, you know, I was 50 years old when she died. I never talked to her about like, what was it like? Now I know she had slave help around, like in the 20s and 30s when she had a nanny who clearly was a remnant of all of that. So my mother grew up into it, but I don't know whether that thing should be there or not. And I took a picture with it. I wasn't smiling and I thought it's still here. You know, my mother's grandfather is still here and the plaque's still there. And I was told by my cousins, the Georgia cousins, that they would kill if anybody ever tried to take that down.
Yeah.
That they're serious. Like, that's on the internet. I saw that. I'm like, at that point, that's when we need to disconnect on Facebook. You know, but that's how people feel about it.
Well, and that's why, you know, the Civil War has been called our most complicated of wars. You know, we're still trying to tease out where we're at with it so many decades later or centuries later. It's amazing. You know, as you talk about that, it's funny how it kind of comes out of nowhere. Years ago, it was 150th anniversary of Lincoln's assassination. And they had actually a very moving ceremony in D.C., right there by the Ford Theater where he had been assassinated. And at about 10:40, I believe, which is about when Booth killed him or shot him, the side doors of the Ford Theater opened up. And they had like a fleet of people carrying candles signifying Lincoln's body being brought across the 10th Street alley to the building where he was, where he died by 7 o'clock the next morning. So I went down and we're kind of lighting candles and we're just kind of memorializing this, you know, marking this. And I lit my candle on one side and we're supposed to kind of light the candle, help the person next to you. I turned and the person on my right was Colin Powell. And I went, whoa, you know, and if, you know, and he was there, he was part of the crowd. And I just went, hang on, and he just went, shh, you know, I'm here, but I'm not here. And so we did the ceremony. And the candles move across the alley going to the boarding house where Lincoln eventually dies. And I turned to talk to Powell, but he was gone. He was like the wind. And yet that's another indication, like your story, of how this war, we try to forget or whatever, kind of reaches out. It still has its hooks in us. And until we come to some kind of, you know, real, you know, decision or way to memorialize it or really remember it, I think it's always going to be there.
Now that I know you know Doris Kearns Goodwin, I got to get her on when the Red Sox are in town and have a real go at her.
Super tight with her, but I love her stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, you dropped her name, like, and I'm like, you know, there's Red Sox. It always comes back to baseball with you. And Tim Wendell's here. He is the professor in residence. I got all of that tenured stuff wrong. Johns Hopkins' new book is out about old things and Rebel Falls. Historical fiction, define that for anyone. Is that sort of like with the Trump administration historical?
No. If anything, facts are probably as important in historical fiction, certainly more so than our political discourse these days.
Kellyanne Conway, you know, alternate facts. Yeah. Is that what it is?
No. That's a whole different universe.
That's what I was trying to come up with. You know,
Kellyanne Conway.
Well, yeah, but your premise is if the South had won the war is the premise, sort of, kind of, right?
Well, no, it's more based, a lot of research went into it because one of the guys, Bennett Burley, was actually from England, soldier of fortune. I went to England, went to the London Library, found all his stuff. And pretty much the twist is not so much if the South had won the war. I mean, that's been done. But how close they came in the waning months of the Civil War from creating an international incident on our northern border. And some people go, oh, what's the big deal with that? There's a great book called A World on Fire by Amanda Foreman. And she indicates that there was so many spies and the potential for international incident along the northern border with Canada, especially in 1863, 1864, that it almost brought in some of the European powers, notably Great Britain, maybe France, whatever. And she maintains, and it's pretty cool, that the right spark, or the right incident, and that's one of the ones I talk about with the seizing of this warship, potentially starts the First World War. There was so much interest at our Civil War that, in a sense, various countries were looking to come in.
Well, we clearly didn't have our ish together, you know, through the 1820s and 30s and 40s. You know, we didn't really know we were going there. That industrialization thing wasn't, you know, really happening there.
Well, one could argue we're not quite sure where we're going right now either, but.
I love real historians. This has been, dude, I called you to say, Mr. Angelos is dead and John Boy's gone and Mr. Rubenstein squirting fans and are excited about it. Next thing I know, we're talking about Doris Kearns Goodwin and other great authors from your hometown. Do you have anything on baseball for me? I mean, that's why I called you. You know, give me some baseball, Tim. Something
Baseball,
baseball.
baseball, baseball.
You remember
Well,
that? The first
yeah,
50 years of your life?
I do remember it. In fact, what we're trying to do, I think we're going to do it next year, is we're going to kind of do a mashup, I believe. I've got to pull this off and I'm out on thin ice here. But one of the books I did was High Heat, where I went in search of the fastest pitcher of all time. And I'm thinking of that as you're talking about Nolan Ryan, who I had some great interviews with.
Well, Sid Finch, if you could find him.
Oh, Sid Finch is in that book too, if you can find him. But that was a marvelous April Fool's thing. But I'm thinking of taking reissuing High Heat, and then taking, in a sense, the four pitchers who have done 20 strikeouts in a game, a major league game, and that would be what? Kerry Wood, Max Scherzer, Roger Clemens, Randy Johnson, and kind
Seaver
of
never
put.
did it, right? Seaver was
Seaver
19.
never did it.
Yeah.
Feller had 18. Nolan Ryan, I believe, had 17 in a game. Unfortunately, you know, he would do almost 17 each
Give me the
game.
four again. Give me, let's do that
Kerry
again.
Wood, Max Scherzer, Clemens does it twice, Randy
Randy
Johnson.
Johnson. Okay.
That's it. And I was at the game where Scherzer did it. In fact, it was one of the most bizarre things. This is a lesson that people, a good baseball lesson, keep score. I mean, in that Scherzer game, you know, the no hitter gets broken up early. All the things you kind of watch for early on in a game. You know, I've been lucky to see what, two no hitters,
I was going to
and
ask you, have you seen a no-hitter?
in fact, the first one I saw was Wilson Alvarez there at Camden, which was a bizarre one because it was like walks and errors and all this stuff. And you're going, hang on, but he hasn't allowed a hit. I better stick around. But in the Scherzer 20 strikeout game, I'm keeping score. And there's really no way in a modern stadium. I mean, they're gonna have the number of strikeouts up, but it doesn't really register. And I was with a really dear friend of mine from Baseball Weekly, Gary Kaczynski, was one of the editors, and we had kind of done a little reunion thing, a bunch of us, and gone to this game at Nats Ballpark, and Gary at about the sixth or seventh inning just goes, "Hang on a minute,
He's got 15 strikeouts.
how many strikeouts you're keeping score? I'm not. How many strikeouts does he have?" And I just counted them up, and he had either 15 or 16 at that point. And the people around this kind of heard that. And I really, all of a sudden, the game took on this other
What's the
element.
record?
What's the record? We're on our phones, like, going, what is the record? It's 20. Kerry Wood did it. You know, Clemens did it twice,
I
etc.
remember Seaver had the record for a long time at 19, right? Like
Yeah.
when I was a kid, maybe, right?
Yeah. But, you know, that got
Seaver
blitzed
was
by.
the when I'm thinking Seaver's, and they've four guys have passed Seaver, so okay.
And
Tells
it's
you how long
funny.
I've been doing this, 32 years on the radio, you know?
It's funny, you know, Kerry Wood came up the other day because my good friend Bill Francis up at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, Kerry Wood just went through there as a visitor, you know, kind of was checking things out. You look at that game, if people want to go deep in the weeds baseball wise, and I guess we are now, look up Kerry Wood's game on YouTube, you know, where he has the 20 strikeouts. That made me the most dominant pitching performance you'll ever see. You could just see the hitters by the second or third time they're going up, they're going, "I don't have a chance." And he had everything working for him that day.
What
He
was your
that
second no-hitter, Tim?
second no hitter was hang on, Scherzer,
Oh, okay.
which was many years later.
You
And
went to a lot of Nats games when they were good then, 10 years ago, huh?
yeah, I did. And it was funny, the story with Scherzer's no hitter. You know, we're from the climate of the press box, right? You don't say no hitter. So I'm even carrying that on. I knew
Special
this.
game. He's having a special game.
Right. He's a
Right.
special game. And I'm with a bunch of people. In fact, I was doing a thing on Cuba. It was a bunch, I talked to a bunch of people about Cuba and Fidel Castro and all this stuff before the game at some luxury suite at the Nats ballpark. And now I said, okay, I'll watch the game with them. And they knew nothing about the game. And now we're in the fifth, sixth, seventh inning, and Scherzer's got a no-hitter going. And it almost had the perfect
And you
game.
might as well be at a cricket game or something that never happens because you don't even understand the rules, right? Like
Right.
literally.
But some of these people sensed something special was going on, and they're going, what's up? Why are people so,
That's a
you know,
zero up
excited?
there. It's a seventh inning.
But I'd even say that. And I had some guys in front of me who
You
weren't a
tell
part of this group, and they knew what was going on.
them.
And I started like, well, you know, and they turned around and just gave me dagger eyes, like going, oh, you better not say it's a no hitter. And I finally said, you know, I finally said, look at the scoreboard. There's something very interesting or unusual going on up there. That's all I can say. And they didn't quite get it at first, and then they got it. And then by the eighth, ninth inning, they were into it. And I still, who was the guy who got hit by Scherzer? And he kind of leaned into the pitch. That kind of destroyed the perfect game. I've never seen a perfect game. That would have been fun.
I have a long, lurid history that I wrote about in my book about my father in 2006, which is now 18 years old, when I did Free the Bird. So here's my no-hitter history. The night Juan Nieves threw the no-hitter, this is back when I had a media credential. I was in the real media. It was 1987, 88, 88, 88, I think.
88, I
It
think.
was 88. It was April 80. It was early in a season, 87, 88, one of those two. Either way, it was very early, very cold, first week of the year. Nieves is a little left-handed guy. And I lived on Kane Street in East Baltimore, and I had a press pass and a parking pass. I could go whenever I want. I went to games all the time. I worked at the newspaper. I went all the time. The press pass is shown in the documentary. You can go see what a press pass looked like in 1986, 87. So, sixth inning of the game, I know he's throwing a no hitter. I mean, it's an Oriole game. I'm watching, listening, whatever you were doing at the time, home team sports or cable vision, whatever it was. I jumped in the car, went over there. I'm 10
Good
minutes
for
away.
you.
So I got over there in the seventh inning, came in, parked in the front. There was nobody there. It's April. There were 7,000 people at the ballpark. Walked up in the press box, got my usual crab cake from the nice ladies up there and sat down and watched the end of the game. The game ended. Robin Yount laid out. Robin Yount, a shortstop, laid out in right center field to rob, I believe it was Eddie Murray. It probably still was Eddie Murray at the end of a game to make the last play of the game. And Jack Gibbons, my boss, said, "Go down and get a sidebar on Nieves." So I went. I was in the locker room when the champagne was flying at Memorial Stadium, but I didn't see the game. I showed up in the set, so I never really considered that a real no-hitter.
I don't know.
So
That's
I
pretty close.
attended several that went seventh inning, eighth inning, like that during my life. Got busted up, Messina, some other stuff like that. Nationally syndicated on Sporting News Radio in 2001. This is 3 weeks before 9/11. It was Labor Day weekend, and I was assigned to do the show in San Diego because Tony Gwynn was retiring, and Tony loved me, and Tony said, "Come on out, I'll sit down with you." And I'm like, "Okay." So I flew out to San Diego for the weekend. I did my show nationally. Afternoon drive, which was midday, 11 to 3 in San Diego, from the press box, the football press box at Jack Murphy Stadium. They set me up. I doing a national show. The Arizona Diamondbacks had just left town. Curt Schilling had just got dealt there. They were about to win the World Series. Schilling, I famously DJ'd his wedding. Don't blame me for his politics, but I was best friends with his wife. We grew up together. She's like a sister to me. So Schilling sat with me and did a half an hour that I was going to run. Tony Gwynn sat down with me. Kevin Towers sat with me. Bruce Bochy sat with me. Tony La Russa sat with me because St. Louis was coming in. National TV game. National TV game. It's the weird 6 o'clock game in an all-day quadruple hitter on Labor Day. I did my show, had everybody on the show. I taped Gwynn the night before. Messina was throwing a perfect game at Fenway Park that night. And on Sunday Night Baseball, and Gwynn and I stopped the interview to watch it. The next day, I'm at the game. My flight was supposed to be 11 o'clock through Chicago to get me back home on United. I did the show. I'm sitting in the press lounge. I'm like, I want to change my flight. Change my flight to 2 hours earlier, which means I need to leave the game like the fourth inning. I was going to fly through LA. It was going to get me home at 5 a.m. instead of 8:50 a.m. or something. 4 hour difference to get home. And I'm like, I'm gonna go through LA and get home. Sat at the game, and I remember a very pretty girl who worked for the Padres befriended me, who knew a ton about baseball. She was a lawyer. And I'm having this great conversation with this really pretty girl. I had tickets. I have tickets. I have my press pass. I sat in the stadium the whole day. And I sat through the first three innings in the box seats right behind. I took this girl's phone number. I said, "I gotta go. I got a flight to catch, my rental car." And as I looked out on the center field wall where the palm trees that Larry Lucchino had grown out there, I saw there had been no hits. Third inning, I saw zero. I'm like, I promise you never leave a game when there's not been a hit, right? I had to leave. Left the game. docked my rental car, flew up to LA, got a nice seat on an all-nighter, flew the whole night, landed at BWI. Shuttle to the airport car, my park and ride. I walked off the plane bleary-eyed in the old A lounge at United Airlines, little tiny little thing, and I walked onto my rental car. I looked down on the USA Today, Mr. Wendell, former Gannett guy, corner box, Smith throws no hitter in San Diego. I walked out of Bud Smith's no hitter on Labor Day after broadcasting all day, after having tickets to the game. I have tickets from it, press pass from it. I broadcast from it, 4 hours of radio with the late, great Kevin Towers and late, great Tony Gwynn. I walked out of a no hitter. It's the only no hitter I ever attended. I walked out of it. How about that? You like that?
Wow.
I walked out of a no hitter. And I walked into a no-hitter. And the David Cone perfect game, that happened on a day against the Expos at Yankee Stadium that Scottie P and I were going to see Springsteen at the Meadowlands that night. And mm-hmm. that morning he called me saying, I don't feel like going. We were going to see David Cone throw a perfect game. So I haven't seen one for real. So I can't brag that I've seen two like you.
No, and you just got to stay put a little bit. You'd be all set.
But I don't go to enough baseball games anymore, but like it is a holy grail. You must admit it's a holy grail, right?
Oh, it is. It is. Well, it's funny. You're going back to that first one that I saw with Wilson Alvarez at Camden. I was up there, you know, I would go up early, do interviews, you know, like you. You're trying to get the stuff.
Standing around the batting cage with the batting coach.
Yeah,
talking
because
ball.
That's,
talking
yeah,
ball.
Yeah. That's the great thing about baseball. You can get so much done before the game. It's not like a big dog pile afterwards. So I was there, I'd done some interviews. I had like the little earbuds on. I was transcribing tape. I was getting my act all together. I was in the back row there at the press box at Camden. And I was getting ready to leave. That was an afternoon game. And part of, you know, me.
You want to get home. It's Sunday.
I wanted
yeah.
to get home. I wanted to get across the American Legion Bridge where it turns into a, you know, a parking lot. And I looked up. And again, it was like a 3-1 game or 4-1 game or something like in the sixth inning when I was getting ready and putting my stuff away. And I looked up and I went, yeah, what a mess, you know, this. And it wasn't a great game. And but then I looked and I saw zero for hits for Baltimore. I went, hang on. I didn't even ask somebody, Alvarez, he's still
count?
In the game? Yeah, I didn't say I knew it counted, but I wanted to make sure Alvarez had been taken out of the game. And they're going, no, Alvarez is still going. And I'm going, okay. And I actually got my little laptop back out. I kind of sat there and ended up doing a sidebar for USA Today that evening. I got home at like a midnight or something.
If you had been at Jack Murphy that night, it would have been your sidebar that I would have been reading about Bud Smith. Tim Wendell's here. The book is now out. We shall say this weekend, Rebel Falls. And he is a baseball historian. He's written so many great – what's the greatest baseball – I mean, maybe you wrote about it, right? I mean, what's the greatest baseball game you ever saw?
Oh, the greatest baseball game I ever saw. It's got to be. Well, I'm going back and forth between a couple here. Maybe Ricky Henderson breaking Lou Brock's record. Not that that was a great game, but that whole day, like I was at one event and then Nolan Ryan supersedes it. And because what Ricky steals breaks Lou Brock's record earlier in that time. And we're on deadline with Baseball Weekly. That was a Monday, Sunday, something like that. And
it was a Sunday midnight deadline, probably on the back end of weekend games. Yeah.
Yes.
There could
and
be
so,
fresh Monday
so
morning.
Ricky breaks the record. I'd been the Ricky guy the whole time. I did the first cover for Baseball Weekly, which was Ricky Henderson. And I'd covered Ricky when I was working in the Bay Area for the San Francisco Examiner. So I'm going crazy. You know, it's all Ricky all the time. Ricky's broken Lou Brock's record, blah, blah, blah.
Did he really referred himself in the third person? Often
yes, he was the first guy I ever did that with. I mean, right. Totally.
When you say Ricky, I say Ricky, and we say Ricky, yeah. And Ricky talked about Ricky is
Ricky
Ricky,
about Ricky.
Not Ricky.
Ricky's hammy is kind of bothering him today. Is going, who's this other Ricky? Literally, the first time he did that, I thought there was a guy named Ricky behind us. You know, Ricky's hurting today. I'm going, Ricky. Okay. But anyway, Ricky breaks Lou Brock's record. I'm writing my brains out, and I think I was still what in the press box or something. And like you, now we're going back to you watching, you know, with Tony Gwynn watching a game, and all of a sudden Ryan is dealing. And he throws the no-hitter that evening. I believe it's his seventh. I might be out of sequence here. And all of a sudden, I get the call going, yeah, great Ricky stuff, but we're tearing it all up. We're going Nolan now, even with the cover. And I literally had got a lot of Nolan Ryan stuff. Nolan Ryan's been great to me over the years. And so I literally wrote two major features in one day because one superstar superseded the other superstar. And that was crazy. And it's not like one game, but in my mind, it blends into this weird dream nightmare of a situation where you think you're done. It's about ready to go out and have a beer and going, no, Nolan Ryan's throwing a no hitter. We better watch this. And if he does throw it, you're writing it. And I did.
Well, it's been quite a month. I had Susan Fornoff talking about the Dave Kingman and the rat a couple weeks ago. So we, you know, the Oakland A's, we can go through all of that. Tim Wendell is one of my dear old friends who was a baseball guy that I love talking baseball history with. But you can go check out his Civil War historical fiction in the new book, Rebel Falls. You can also, how do people find? You're out on the interweb. You're out on the Twitter and the tweets and the X's all that stuff. And
all that
you
stuff.
Have next project up or no? This is the only project right now.
You sound like my agent a little bit. Yeah, it's time to get some other stuff going. I may stick around with some historical fiction for a little bit. I had a lot of fun with this. So.
I'm trying to write, you know, like total fact and everything that's going on here with the baseball team.
It's been
quite a, you know, transformation in the last couple of months. I'm still trying to process A, whether I'm getting my press credential back, B, whether this guy's a right guy or not, squirting fans and Cal Ripken and, you know, signing players and trying to grow the brand. Fix downtown. There's a lot going on here on the baseball side, and it's the first time in a long time we've got like real positive activity happening here. So it's only been three decades. It's only been 40 years since we've had a World Series here. So Tim, hopefully when there is a World Series here, I'll be sitting next to you and you'll be chronicling it for someone.
That's right. Reputable. And somebody will be throwing a no-hitter and we'll stick around.
Rub it in, will you? Rub it in. Tim Wendell here, writer in residence at Johns Hopkins University, a baseball historian and real author, unlike, you know, me, just writes books for fun. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.